Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 19, delivered on April 8, 2019. The title of this lecture is Capital Budgeting.
Today, capital budgeting. Now, I'm going to bring up some, if you have a calculator or virtual TI, it's going to do you a lot of good to have it for this session because some of this would be take you a while to do. Some of them would take you quite a while to do. On the calculator, they happen in the blink of an eye, as long as you key in the numbers properly. Let me just start you out, and I'm going to just dive in and do some problems. And I'm going to do it the hard way at first, and then I'm going to show you how a financial calculator can make your life a lot easier with these kinds of problems. And I'm going to pull up two different calculators. First, I'm going to pull up, I'm going to have up here a basic scientific calculator and then the TI-83. And take you on a journey here. Okay. You invest $100 today, and you will receive $102 in 1 year, and $105 in 2 years. Should you make this investment? Now, the problem here is that, first of all, when we ask the average person, we do some questions on financial literacy, and we will get an immediate yes on this. But it's not that clear at all that the answer is yes. First of all, the reaction most people have is that, well, I'm getting $7 more than what I put in. But you are not, because that is there is no $7 there. As a matter of fact, there's no $102 there. There is no $105 there. We have to make those into numbers that are in the same units as this $100, because you see that $100 is now dollars. That $102 is future one-year dollars. And $105 is even further in the future. So we have to discount these back, and there's a problem. We would have to have a discount rate for taking present values. Remember, finding present values is discounting, finding future values is compounding. Well, we have to have... So we would have to find the risk-adjusted discount rate for those future for the rate for the future cash flows. In other words, we have to, by some means, find an interest rate. Now, there are a couple of ways we could do that. Of course, we could just guess, or we could use the capital asset pricing model, or we could use some other discounting number. We could look at a bank and say, all right, what's the rate being paid on a one-year deposit? What's the rate being paid on a two-year deposit? We could do that way, too. But one way or the other, we need a discount rate. Let's say that discount rate is 8%. And I mentioned this earlier in the semester, and in some cases, it really does help to visibly and actually physically draw a cash flow line. So here I have a two-year cash flow line where you are going to put in as a negative $100 at time zero. And then you're going to have a positive cash flow from it of $102 in a year, and another positive cash flow of $105 in 2 years. And so we have to discount that $102 back at 1 plus 0.08 to the negative 1 year. And then we're going to honk that $105 back at the discount rate, 1 plus 0.08 to the negative 2. Then we can compare it to the negative $100. And whipping that out, the 102 times 1.08 to the negative 1 is actually worth $94 now. So that's $94 in now dollars. So we haven't covered in the first year our investment. And then to that, we're going to say $105 times 1.08 to the negative 2 power. And that's $90.02. What is that? $90. I'm sorry, $90.02. $90.02. What is that first number? Plus the first number, 94.44. So the negative 100 plus 94.44 plus 90.20. I was just testing you. Let's try that one more time. 90.02 plus, it was 02? Okay, thank you. I am forever doing that kind of thing. And then I wonder why my results are... You know what? Wow. Oh, I should really stop deleting those emails about homes for people when they get old. Plus 84.46. So put these together. Well, no, actually, in this case, 84.46. This number down here at the bottom is called the net present value. The net present value. This is the economic profit from the investment. It is positive, so we say yes. If it's negative, we say no. There is no nuance. If it's negative 14 cents, no. If it's positive 3 cents, yes. If it's positive 0, you kind of say, well, yes and no. I'd say yes to it. If it's 0, you say yes. This is how we decide whether projects are go or no go. We find out what the free cash flow or net income or whatever you want to use, the free cash flow for the project is over a projected time horizon, then you telescope it back in and compare it to what you put out. And at the end, you just say yes if it's positive, no if it's negative. Now, let me do this on this here calculator, financial calculator. And the calculator turned off on me. apps, finance. You go down here to 7, that's NPV, enter. Now it will open up, and the first thing you do is you put in your interest rate. Comma, you put in the negative cash flow, negative 100, comma. Now, the next thing you do, when you are telling this calculator that you have a positive cash flow coming, you start by announcing it with braces. That is second on the parenthesis button. Be careful because you'll get an error. If you get an error, first thing you look at is, did I put in a parenthesis instead of a brace? The braces announce, here comes positive cash flow. And then you just put them in 102, comma, 105, in order of the periods of the interest rate. So if this was a monthly interest rate, I would put in the cash flows by month. If you have a year or something like that where there was a zero, just key it in. Don't leave it out, for heaven's sakes. Now, you say, all right, second, close the brace. That tells the TI-83 end of positive cash flow. Then you close a parenthesis because the whole mess started that way. And you say, enter. There it is. Trust me, if you've got a long cash flow, say you've got a multi-year project, this makes it so much faster to do the problem. Now, Excel will do the same trick, and I will do that on Wednesday. I will do a more realistic one for actually valuing stock by looking at the periods of the free cash flow year by year on it. But this is how you do it. It is that simple to work it out. Now, reality is that most projects are going to come up either negative or slightly positive NPV in the real world. Finding positive net present value projects is a little bit unusual. The question would be, why hasn't anyone already figured this out and then drained the free cash flow from the future by selling the product in the market or whatever and taking away profit from you. Another consideration, this is pretty much the golden standard right now for project valuation, capital budgeting. Now, when I say capital budgeting, what projects do we budget for in the long haul versus what projects do we throw out? This is the golden standard, the net present value. Is this the one that's actually used? Not all companies use it. As a matter of fact, we are still, to this day, having companies that use an extraordinarily primitive, wrong method to do capital budgeting. And in fact, almost all textbooks actually will show you this and then tell you what's wrong. The reason they show it to you is because companies are still using it. When I was a consultant, I was amazed at the number of companies that use this primitive, incorrect method instead of NPV. There is a competing method out there that is valid in some circumstances. That's called internal rate of return. I'll get to that in a minute. But let me go back, and I want to show you this false method that is still this bad method. It was used for centuries and centuries, and it's still being used. I think I saw a survey that was done that found that like 30% of companies use NPV, which is the standard. Then there were another 45, something like that, percent that use internal rate of return, which can get you a wrong answer. But it's still a valid method. And then there was this tail of this big group of companies. They still use this. It's called the payback method. Okay, watch. A company accepts projects only if they pay back the original investment. Within 4 years. So let's look at a project. Projects A and B and year. Year 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Year 0. Project A in year 0 pays costs $800. It returns positive $100 in year 1, positive $200 in year 2. Oops, let me get that lined up there for you. Positive $200 in year 2. Positive $400. No, positive $200. I'm sorry. In year 4 and 3, and then positive 100 in year 5. Okay. Positive 200 in year 6, in year 5, 200. And then in year 6, there's a tail of salvage value of $50. So Project A costs $800 up front, and then it delivers in years 1 through 6. 100, 200, 200, 100, 200, 50. Now, Project B costs, at the initial outlay, $1,200. It pulls in, in the first year, it pulls in $200. In year two, it pulls in $600. In year three, it pulls in $800, and then in year 4 it pulls in $200, and in year 5 it pulls in $100, and then there's nothing in year 6. Now what I'm showing you is the payback period, the payback method. This company will take projects only if they return what it costs to do them in 4 years. That's its policy. So we would look at Project A. Project A is at year one, $700, still $700 in the hole. In year two, the project pulls in another $200, so it's $500 in the hole. In year three, it pulls in another $200, so it's still $300 in the hole. In year four, it pulls in another $100, so it's $200 in the hole. Is that right? Yeah. And then in year five, it breaks even on it, and then in year six, it's up $50. This project will be rejected because it didn't cover the cost of investment within 4 years. It was still in the hole in year four, so it's done. You say no to the project. Now look at Project B. Project B starts out $1,200 in the hole. After 1 year, it is still $1,000 in the hole. In year two, it is still $400 in the hole. In year three, it is up $400. In year four, it is up $600. And in year five, it is up $700. This project paid for itself in 3 years. About 2.5 years. Okay? So this project we will accept. That's all there is to the payback method. There are two fundamental flaws with this method. The first one is that it does not take account for the time value of money. You see how in both of those projects, the 100 and the 200 in year one, they are being considered in the same dollar units as the original investment. Every year's cash flow for that year is being treated as if it is the same as the year before in terms of value, and it's not. That $100 in year one for Project A is not comparable to the negative $800. It is future money, not now money. The same for the other one. That positive $200 in year one for Project B, that's not $200 in terms of the original $1,200. And every year, you are counting that year's individual cash flow, incremental cash flow, against the year before, which means nothing. You can't do, well, you can do it. People are obviously doing it, but it's not valid because it doesn't take into account the erosion of the value of money as time goes on. And then there's another problem here too, and this is a problem actually that shows up in the internal rate of return method. At first, your reaction when you go out into the workplace is to just do whatever you're told. Never, don't ask a why. But here the question is, where does that 4 years come from? That is just something that's pulled out of a company. A lot of times these companies, I ran into at least three that I can remember. I asked them, well, where did you get this number of years for your payback? Well, we've always used that. That's how we always did it. 4 years, 3 years. One company had a 6-year payback. And I said, well, where did that 6 years come from? Well, that's what we've always used, and that's what we're always going to use. 6 years. Mm-hmm. There's no reason, there's no theoretical or practical explanation. It's just whatever the company pulls out of its butt. And probably it was set years ago, so those who are using it now don't know why they're using it. They just know that that's the company policy, to use a 6-year, 4-year, whatever year payback. And then there's another problem, too. And this is actually kind of a problem with net present value. These methods have a bias for projects that quickly turn profitable in terms of free cash flow. You see, the quicker a company starts, a project starts pumping out positive cash flow, the faster, the more likely it is to be accepted. But the problem is that especially when you're talking about massive capital projects, you're probably not going to see any meaningful cash flow for years, possibly even decades. There's not going to be any positive cash flows on mining asteroids until the late 2020s or the 2030s, more likely. It's going to be no positive cash flow. There's probably, for a lot of high-tech projects that we're doing now, like research on fusion reactors, positive cash flow is still, well, I mean, when we started it back in the 1970s, we knew darn well the positive cash flows from fusion reactors wouldn't come for at least a half a century. Well, here we are about 40 years later, and we're still probably about 7 to 10 years from the first commercially viable fusion reactors. Once they come, my God, the cash flow will be staggering from them because they can generate energy with simple materials. They're going to be very expensive to build the thing, and they also will solve amazing problems that we have, like trash. We can put trash into the plasma from fusion reactors and it just disappears for all intents and purposes. So a lot of the most important projects that companies could contribute to the long-term technological survival of a civilization are going to take years and years. Payback method is going to shoot them down every time. Unfortunately, like I said, net present value probably does that to a certain extent too, because if you've got a cash flow positive that's out 30 years, then that's going to have a very small value in terms of net, in terms of present value. So there's a problem there as well. And that's something that I'll get into on Wednesday a little bit more deeply. However, That having been said, I'm going to take another project. First, we're going to do the net present value of it. Bear with me 1 minute here while I kill something. Net present value. Apps. I'm going to have to find something here very quickly. 1.7. Negative. Oops, I'm sorry. 8, comma, negative 2,000. Comma, and then I'm going to put in some cash flows here. And I'm setting something up so that I can have it for you to see here once I key in. Okay, now I think I've got it here. Okay, so alpha close. Okay. Let me set this up here. A project with a discounted risk-adjusted discount rate of 8% and an initial cost of $10,000. Will return free cash flow of $2,000 of $1,000 the first year, $2,000 the second year, $3,000 the third year, $4,500 the fourth year, $5,000 the fifth year, $4,000 the sixth year, and 20 and $2,000 in the seventh year, at which time the project will end with a salvage value of $500. Should we accept or reject the project? Let's catch up with me for a minute here. First things first, I threw in a salvage value. The way you deal with that is you simply put it on the cash flow of the final year. That's all you ever do if you see a salvage value. That $500, I'm just going to smack that thing on the $2,000 in the seventh year. That's all you do. Don't panic, don't worry about it. It's just a little tail there. Interestingly, though, that tail can be quite important to the extent that a lot of companies ignore, they don't ignore it as far as accounting goes. Of course, you have to figure out what that is for tax purposes. But for practical purposes, they don't think about it. And I think I told you about the story of the haunted basement here at the State Farm Hall of Business. There's a big room with a lot of ancient computers. And in many companies, there's a warehouse with ancient equipment. It was never sold. Nothing was ever done with it. Or it was just junked instead of realizing the salvage value, which companies should do. If you're going to have a company that replaces its computers every 3 years, then you should not be throwing those away. You should be selling them or donating them. Yes? It was just the way things are in a lot of institutional environments. And I mean, this is not that unusual. My goodness, I've been in universities and colleges where you had computers that were like from the 1980s. And sometimes in the 70s, of course, for me, oh my God, it's a classic. I can make that thing run again, yeah. But I mean, if they had taken those and donated them to schools, there would have been a tax benefit from the charitable donations of the basis of the salvage, of the salvage value. Something, don't just leave stuff to rot. But it is something, well, yeah, we'll put them down in the basement until we figure out what to do with them. Now let's get those brand shiny new computers in here. Wow. And they forget about all that stuff that's down there that they've been accumulating. Literally, it was one of the schools here in town where I was teaching. There was this vast cavern. It was creepy down there anyway. They had, way before your time, they had these, have you ever seen floppy disks? You know, they were like the predecessor. Before we call the hard diskette, they had floppies. They were like 5 1/4 inches. Before the floppies, they had these monster things that were, floom. In my time, the first hard drive that was commercially, well, there were some, but a 10 megabyte hard drive would run about $5,000 back in the early 80s. And boy, that thing could hold. I mean, wow, that could hold. Now you bitch if you don't have a terabyte of drive space, hard drive space. But yeah, I mean, they were extraordinarily expensive at the time. But of course, with technology moving as fast as it is these days, it appears that they have no value to the company. When in fact, there are schools that would just love to have some computers and some charitable organizations that would like to have some computers. Okay, let me... let me crank this out for you here. Apps, finance, TVM solver. Oh, TVM solver. My bad. I do that for so long in the class I forget. Okay, now 7 is NPV. Now notice it'll pop back up. Okay, and I'm going to show you a couple of stupid pet tricks here, but the first thing we're going to do is just get in the numbers. 8.00, and I always put 2 decimal places, and you'll see why in a minute or two. And then always your discount rate first. Always discount rate first. Then next, just a comma and your cash outflow, negative $10,000. And then a comma, don't forget the comma, and now you're going to say, all right, calculator, I'm opening braces, that means here comes the positive cash flow. And I'm going to honk that in, 1,000, comma, 2,000, comma, 3,000, comma, where the hell am I? 4,500, comma, 5,000, comma, 4,000, comma, and then the 2,000 plus the 500. Again, always put in your salvage value on the back ear. Now we close the braces, second, close parenthesis, then close a parenthesis to initialize the function, enter. $5,712. Now, don't get picky with pennies. I suppose the book's going to. I suppose the homework will make you. But $5,712. Discount rate. NPV. So at an 8% discount rate, this is a positive net present value. It's a go. Okay, suppose now someone says, oh, wait, you weren't supposed to use 8%. This is an extraordinarily risky project. I didn't say 8%. I said 18%. Oh, God, do I have to put those all back in? No, you don't. Watch. Second, enter. And it brings up the thing you just did, and you can go in and edit it. Now, if you just key in, it will overwrite 18.0. Now, if you want to put in more, you have to say second insert, 0. Now, this is very nice if you're actually having to calculate something over and over again, just to open the function, open what you did, and edit it. But don't forget, it's going to overwrite automatically. If you wanted to insert instead of overwrite, you have to say second insert up there at the very top of the keys. Now we can just say enter. Oh. Now it's only an $883. Oh my. As the interest discount rate is going up, the net present value is going down. What would happen if we put in 22%? Well, that's easy to do. Second, enter, and then we just go up there and we put in 22%. Hit enter. Oh, it's negative. Negative 469. Well, isn't that odd? So in other words, if my horizontal axis is my discount rate and my vertical axis is my net present value, and I put in some grid lines here. Oops, good heavens. I'm on the wrong axis. Whew, boy, this day is not going well. So this one would be 1,000, let's say 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000. $5,000, $6,000, and then I discount rate 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%. 1, 2, 3, 4, 10%. 1, 2, 3, 4, 15%. 1, 2, 20%. 1, 2, 3, 25%. Okay, now, let's have a look. At an 8% discount rate, my net present value was $5,700. Right about there. At an 18% discount rate, my net present value had fallen to a little under $1,000, $883. And at 22%, I had gotten slightly negative to about $400. Finally. This is a net present value function. Every project will have its own NPV function graph. It's generally a linear graph, but there is net present value, but as a function of the discount rate you use. Now, there's something going on here. If you notice, there is a discount rate here. It looks like about 20.8% where the net present value goes from positive to negative. There is a place where a discount, where a net present value goes from positive to negative. And it looks to me like that is about 20.8%. We call that the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. Now, back in the old days, what we would have to do to find the exact internal rate of return is keep trying with a large bracket, 18 to 25%. Well, we know it's somewhere, it's positive at 18%, at 8%, I should say. It's negative at 25%, so we know it's in there. So we try 10%. Okay, it's positive there. We back up and we just keep calculating NPV, this was before calculators, until we got to a level of accuracy for the NPV to be zero. That could take literally for a normal person 30, 40 minutes to do, especially without calculator. You were using a slide rule, or if you're lucky, you got onto a supercomputer or something like that. But we don't have to do that anymore. No, because you see, there is a function that allows us to do that, to find the internal rate of return. When you use it, it looks just like the entries for NPV, except you don't tell it a discount rate. That's what you wanted to get you. So it is identical in keystroke entry to the NPV, except you don't put anything in like a 22% comma. You don't do that. So watch this. I'm going to actually reopen the NPV function. Then I'm going to take my cursor up to the NPV letters themselves. And then I'm going to say apps, finance, scroll down to 8. Well, looky there, there's IRR, internal rate of return, enter. It replaced my NPV with IRR. But remember, you don't put in an interest rate, so I have to delete that interest rate that was in the NPV calculation. And now I'm going to hit enter. I said I'll hit enter. Okay, 20.53%. I wasn't off too much there. Obviously, graphing is a good way to do it, but you have, that was how our cheat method was, to graph a couple of points and then connect them. But you have to be really precise with your graph if you're going to find IRR by graphing the NPV function. You have to be, you know, with a mechanical pencil and grid paper and all that. But there you go. There's your internal rate of return right there. That, those are the two classic methods. Now, the NPV is direct. If it's positive, accept. If it's negative, you reject. The internal rate of return is a little subtle. Let's try this. Let's try this. Your project will cost $8,000. It will deliver 2,000 dollars in the first year, $5,000 in the second year, and $1,600 in the third year, with a salvage value of $100. Now, I'm going to find the internal rate of return. I'll show you how you can use it very effectively. It's important for you to know this. I will ask this on the final exam. Guarantee you. and I will be probing. If you understand this topic, it is a no-brainer, but it kills you if you don't. So apps, finance, internal rate of return. Now I've got a cash outlay of $8,000, comma. Now open braces, here comes the positive cash flow. What did I say there? $2,000, $5,000, $1,600, $2,000, $5,000, $1,600 with a $100 tail on the salvage. See how you can even do, you can do simple math within the actual cash flow stream. On most TIs, I should qualify. I watch this, it'll probably won't work on this one. Now I close the braces, close the parentheses, crank it. 4.38% is my internal rate of return. By the way, don't capitalize. If you're writing out internal rate of return, don't capitalize it. That's just the letters are capitalized. 4.38%. Okay? Well, what does that buy us? Let me try this. You, madam. Your boss gave you the numbers, said, I'll get you a discount rate tomorrow so you can accept or reject. Well, you know, that's wonderful. Okay, so you got it already, you did the internal rate of return, but obviously you don't have the discount rate, so you can't know whether to accept or reject. Well, you're expecting your boss to come back tomorrow, but instead the chief financial officer just walks up to you. This is not just any chief financial officer. This chief financial officer comes in wearing a black robe, the discount rate you should use is 6%. Tell me right now, accept or reject. Come on, right now. Can you tell me? Look at the profile. What's NPV if you're above IRR? It's negative. Look at the graph. Look at the graph over there. You see it? 6%. Do I accept or reject? Tell me now or I will throttle you with my thoughts. Yahtzee. That's all. You see, once you know the internal rate of return, you know exactly what it's going to be accepted or rejected on any discount rate I'd give you for the project. That's the power of the internal rate of return. Once you know what it is, it doesn't really matter what they tell you for the discount rate. You know instantly if it's above. If the discount rate is above the internal rate of return, you reject. If the discount rate is below the internal rate of return, you accept. So if I'd said 4%, you would have said accept. If I'd said 3%, you would have accepted because those are below the IRR, and you see the NPV function is always positive above the internal rate of return. So once you know the IRR, it's not going to really matter. You don't have to do any calculation. That's all there is to it right there. So that is a nice use of the internal rate of return. However, there is a twist on this that is quite popular. It is by far the most common use of internal rates of return. And it is dodgy. The term is hurdle rate. Let me explain to you how a hurdle rate works. It might, if it doesn't instantly hit you, it's not that you're from Decatur. although you might be. It might take you a minute or maybe a couple of hours to kind of let it soak in. But here's how a hurdle rate works. A company has set a hurdle rate for all projects of 12%. Now, I'm going to give you projects and ROIs, return on investments, okay? Project A, B, C, D. Project A has an ROI of 9.5%. Project B has an ROI of 14.6%. Project C has an ROI of 13.0%. And Project D has an ROI of 6.5%. And I'm going to X this out and put in its place internal rate of return. Leave that there, but put an X through it, because consider this ROI an internal rate. This is the internal rate of return. Okay? So now, watch. Okay, so NPV is on this axis. Notice how I'm not going to write any NPVs. I'm not going to worry about the actual dollar numbers. The hurdle rate this company has set is this right here, this 12%. Now, Project A crosses at 9.5%. I don't know much about what it looks like, but I do know that Project A looks like this. It has to, because that's what NPV functions look like. They cross at their internal rate of return. So there's Project A right there. Project B crosses at 14.6%. That's what ROI, that's what IRR means. So whatever however steep it is, flat it is, I know that Project B looks like this. It crosses at 14.6%. It crosses the discount rate axis. Project C, okay, look at these two. Look at Project A. At the hurdle rate of 12%, is Project A positive or negative NPV? Try it again. At the hurdle rate of 12%, is Project A a positive or a negative net present value project?
Negative.
Yahtzee, exactly. So we would reject Project A. Follow on with me. Project B, at 12%, is it a positive or a negative NPV project? Bingo. You see, the hurdle rate is going to tell you, so A, its internal rate of return is below the hurdle rate, so we say no. Project B, the internal rate of return is above the hurdle rate, so we say yes. Now, do it. C, will we say yes or no?
Yes,
absolutely. Good. Excellent. D, well, spank me Jesus. We've got it. There's a problem here, though. This is actually very common. This method is of internal rate of return, using internal rate of return instead of NPV. This is the most common use of IRR. They set a hurdle rate for the company's projects. Now, here's the problem with it. it suffers the same basic flaw as payback. I asked, literally, it was like 2 years ago. I was just doing some light help work with a company, and they had a hurdle rate of 15%. I said, where did this 15% come from? Well, I don't know. We just had it since we founded the company, and they founded the company in 1989. You've used the same hurdle rate for all these years? Well, yeah, what's wrong with that? Interest rates in the economy haven't stayed the same. The second problem also is that you set the hurdle rate, you're basically setting, without knowing it, the risk level of your company. You set that hurdle rate high. Only high internal rates of return, in other words, high ROIs, in other words, risky projects, are all you're going to ever take. That project D, it's a lower risk project. It's got a lower IRR. So what? It's still a project, and it might be a profitable project. But you, by setting the hurdle rate, you, before any other considerations, you just say, no, we don't take low-risk projects. A low-risk project can be a profitable project, for God's sake. And a high-risk project might be the project that ends your company's life. But, so setting, doing this has a couple of deep flaws in it, but again, my problem is not to show you the deep flaws so much as to just say this is how it's done out there. Now, I will show you a couple of twists on this, and another reason IRR can actually give you wrong answers, and that's in the class on Wednesday. That's all I have for you today. Thank you.